Where to turn for help when taking care of aging loved ones. Maine is already known for being the oldest state, and now it's reached the point of being what's called super-aged, where one-fifth of the state's population is now older than 65. An article in today's Washington Post outlines some of the challenges Maine faces, a rapidly aging population combined with fewer younger workers to care for them. The Post describes Maine as foreshadowing the problems to come in other states, as the number of seniors is projected to double between 2015 and 2050 nationwide. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we'll explore the challenges of caring for older people and where those providing care can turn for advice. The challenges of elder care. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Caring for an aging friend or family member can be deeply rewarding, but it can also be very overwhelming. Today, we're going to try to get answers to your questions about elder care challenges, from navigating issues of paperwork and process to how best to get help when you, as the caregiver, don't know where to turn for support. My guests today are three individuals very involved in elder care matters. Dr. Jabbar Fazeli is a geriatrician and co-chair of the Maine Partnership to Improve Dementia Care in Nursing Homes. Anne Quinlan is the founder of Healthy Aging Matters. And Bethany Lawrence is a registered nurse and founder and president of Aging Excellence. Thank you all for joining us today. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you helped care for an aging family member or friend? What obstacles have you run into? Any advice for others in the same boat? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And I think I'll start with you, just because today there happened to be a Washington Post article highlighting some of the problems with elder care. And in fact, it focused on Maine, saying that Maine, being the state with the oldest average age of its population, kind of foreshadows what's to come for the rest of the country. And it goes to describe the very difficult combination of more people aging, fewer people to care for them. So how do you see that problem playing out here in Maine?
Well, of course, if we continue to address it as a problem, we may not find the solution. So I would say that looking at areas of Maine, particular areas of Maine, like rural Maine, I have worked in those regions, and I've been impressed by the quality of family, the family caregiver. That's not to say that they don't need assistance and help. We need to begin looking at our younger population coming along, perhaps giving them, not mainstreaming them, but giving them the option to experience what it's like to be around a person with dementia. There's a lot of fear that's being promoted around that particular aspect of aging. And in truth, young people and older people get along. It's a natural marriage, really, in a sense. And I would encourage people to start looking at how can they engage young people, not necessarily as a career path, but ultimately it could be. I do believe that a lot of this care comes out of an avocation, not necessarily a vocation, but an avocation and loving being around older people. And that's one part of it that I would like to see nurtured more, intergenerational communication.
Okay, so you see it as actually an opportunity.
I do.
I was going to ask you about that, Beth. Some of the problems that were raised in the article, the Washington Post article, was that Maine, like other states, is basically facing a shortage of workers who can afford the low pay of being a caregiver, and your organization has looked at that to some degree, correct?
Yes, that is so relevant in our work presently. So we have seven locations in Maine and a location in New Hampshire, and low unemployment rates and being the oldest state in the nation, we have really tried to be very strategic and creative in building our workforce. And I think that the two things that come to mind for me, the quality of caregiver that we have in the state of Maine is exceptional. And we want to value and reward them into this type of career. And so what we've done recently is really try to elevate their rate of pay as well as benefits and a culture that they want to be involved in, like Anne was saying. And so, you know, we look at diversity. We're looking at all different types of individuals and providing a supportive work environment, education, and better pay rates to maintain that level of caregiver that is expected within the state.
Okay, and what we're really looking at today is what are those challenges of elder care and what's that all about? So Dr. Fazeli, as a geriatrician, you see the whole spectrum of problems that affect people's health, especially as they age. What are some of the most common overall problems that your patients are facing?
Well, it depends on the setting where they live. I want to just mention one thing about the shortage of workers. We're not only having a shortage, the population is going to eventually decline. So as the population ages and stays in Maine, the younger folks are leaving. So we have to look for innovative ways of finding workers from 2030 and beyond where there aren't enough Mainers to care for Mainers.
Right. That's a big question. Yeah. We've looked at on Maine Calling for a couple different shows.
Right.
As far as, again, with elder care and the kind of problems that are specific to that area, what are you seeing?
The folks that come to the clinic are primarily struggling to stay home independently. So that's really the primary issue that I deal with in terms of making sure they stay independent. And that's, of course, it's multifaceted. It starts with the fact that they're getting older and staying home later. And so over 80 population, almost 50% or more, have an incident of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
So the older you get, the more likely that you will be dealing with Alzheimer's or other dementias. And that impacts their ability to independently care for themselves, decision-making, being able to be left alone between the times where the family members are coming in. So once it becomes a 24-hour issue, that becomes the greatest challenge as far as the people who are at home. The ones who are in nursing homes, my greatest challenge is to keep them off medications that are used just to calm them down. So my struggle is to teach caregivers as well as workers that the expectation of an Alzheimer's patient is not for them to be fully compliant, doing the things we ask them to do, when we ask them to do, and what kind of medications are harmful and even not helpful.
So for all of these problems, you're really dealing with the caregivers as much as you are with the patients themselves.
Absolutely. And caregiver stress is one of the biggest reasons that people end up being placed. And so when you have PCA services, personal care attendants going home to supplement the family work, that's one of the crucial things that are part of the care plan.
Okay.
To supplement the caregiver so that they're not burnt out, but even nursing home workers can be burnt out because of either lack of training or the fact that they have to deal with so much.
Right. Okay, you've touched upon a whole bunch of topics that we'll get to more, but you did also mention the independence factor as one of the biggest challenges. And Beth, I know that your organization helps older people try to stay active and try to stay independent, but why is independence a priority? Why is that a goal?
You know, most of the people that we work with want to stay as active and independent as possible so that they can remain in the environment that they choose. So we really work in the forefront. We have a lot of services, and it's a broad, when we speak to home care, a lot of people think regarding medical care. But we really try to encourage independence and buoy people up with, on the front end, all kinds of different assistance to help people with the typical challenges of aging. So, you know, when we speak about non-medical elder care, we're speaking of companion services for socialization, to help them with activities, with transportation to stay connected in their communities, and also as much assistance with nutrition. So we help them with meal preparation, grocery shopping, light housekeeping, a wellness program. There's a handyman chore service as well as, you know, geriatric care managers that can all help problem solve if there's any issues. And so I think, you know, most of our people, like Dr. Fazeli was saying, would preferably stay in the environment of their choice. And so with a little bit of service strategically placed, then that allows them to do that.
So what you're talking about is somebody not necessarily bringing in someone to their home, but you giving them tips on how to manage these transportation issues or daily tasks and how to kind of deal with those one by one.
Right, exactly. That's twofold. We could provide transportation or we can provide resources.
Right.
And, you know, the other thing that comes to mind when we're speaking regarding the home care shortage, and we've really tried to work a lot, too, with families regarding use of technology. And that's helped a lot with remote monitoring or assistive devices to help people maintain their independence at home as well.
Okay. And Anne, I understand you've organized a conference on this topic of elder care, which is coming up next Saturday.
Yes.
And one of the main topics that you'll be talking about there is how to navigate the healthcare system.
Yeah. I think probably for, and I'll speak for myself in terms of my own experience, that our healthcare system, and I'm using that term very broadly, but essentially when it comes to an elder, it's so confusing for families, beginning to translate the language of healthcare. And the language is changing every day. Main care is changing. Experiencing, say, meeting a family at an emergency room, you know, and there's been an emergency, then this whole decision about will the person get admitted, and especially a person with dementia, I have created a small card that I give my clients that just simply says, this person has dementia, would you kindly move us to a quiet area? The confusion in a waiting room exacerbates that person's level of anxiety. And so the calmer they are, then the sooner they can get to the medical need or whatever that may be. I would say that the language of healthcare, again, going back to that, the system itself, you know, everybody says the system is broken, but it's not broken when it comes to that particular family. They want to do the right thing by their family. And they want to do the right thing by their parent or by that elder. So I basically do a lot of coaching. I do a lot of mediation. Very often there's a conflict within a family as to who's in charge. And that's one of the first questions I like to ask. How can I help, but who's in charge? Because it's really helpful to get to that key person. And Beth probably and Dr. Fuseli would agree with that getting to that key person who has been the point person for that elder within that family, then we can all sit down and work something out. There's a lot of negotiation within families, especially if there's more than maybe two or three siblings. And very often that sibling who has been either self-appointed or by default becomes appointed, they really need the support of the other siblings and they need the support of the extended community. Because again, ideally, keeping that person at home is the optimum way to keep them healthy.
And Dr. Fuseli, you mentioned a plan for all of this. Is there sort of a way you approach that if you say what Anne's saying, you figured out the point person, you figured out sort of what the needs are. How does a family or a caregiver and the patient go about formulating a plan for what they then do?
Right. Well, we, as a geriatrician, I do a lot of case management as part of that. So you match the needs with what's available intrinsically at the family level. And then you identify the gaps. And you say, well, you need 2 days a week, daycare, for example, to give the caregiver a break. You need to call a place like Age in Excellence or others to get 2 hours a day help in the morning so you can go shopping and do whatever you need to do. So you really have to match. Every individual family has different abilities and they have different support systems. The challenge is sometimes when you don't have a family. I, in fact, saw somebody in my office for a consultation this week, yesterday, who, you know, was a career woman and is independent and has no family. And the closest people that provide support are her neighbors and friends. And you got to basically navigate that with the patient, with the caveat that some of the recommendations you make, the person who hears them, if it's only the dementia patient, they may not remember them.
Right.
So you have to put it down. You have to have ancillary services. You have to have a case manager if they have the finances for it. If they don't, then you access resources within the community to try to basically remind them what they need from week to week.
But I'm assuming you as the physician, you can't be the total case manager. So where does someone begin if they come to you and they don't even know where to start with all this? Right. They ask you and you refer them to an agency? How does that work?
A geriatrician is a case manager light. So I do the blueprint, discuss the general plan, and then I would refer for the specifics. For example, I would say you need help at home, but then these are the resources to call for help at home. If you can't manage those calls and navigate the system, case manager, a geriatric case manager, is your first stop.
Okay.
After my visit.
So let's talk about some of those specifics. We will at least touch upon them. Beth, if somebody has reached that stage, they want to know, okay, here's one of the first things I need help with is my dad shouldn't be driving. What do I do?
That's a tough one. So.
Okay, I'm asking from personal experience.
Right. I'm not going to code that. So okay. That's a difficult discussion. But I think you're right. I think that you have to inform and educate the family to the resources. And I always like to involve, you know, the client so that it's client-centered care, so that all of the decisions you try to be respectful of and responsive to that individual client. So we find out, you know, what is the transportation needs? You know, what are the interests of the client? When are they needed? What resource can we provide so that this will be somewhat seamless? You know, do you get a driver? Can you use Uber? Can you, you know, use public transportation? What would be the solution to this? And then you sit down and say, okay, unfortunately, we do have to revoke the driver's license, but here are the options to help you.
Okay. And similarly with things, daily tasks like cooking or bathing and dressing, you sort of assess each situation and recommend to the caregivers when they need help and when they don't?
Yeah. So, you know, we try to do that. We have a service plan that we would fill out. And, you know, it's always best if you are connected with a company like ours in the elder care industry, where you might start smaller and introduce one service. And then if you need more and more service, you can add that on, and it's not as intrusive to the individual. So definitely there's just a lot of different services that can be added at any time. But it's, you know, the one thing I would say too in this climate, with facilities having wait lists and even our industry now wait lists, that you should really get connected sooner than later to the home care industry, because you don't want to wait until a crisis and you need, you know, help right away. And a lot of times people think that they call and there's somebody going to be responsive that day or next week. And sometimes it's several weeks before a caregiver can be scheduled because of the tight situation in Maine.
Okay, so the question then is, what if people have trouble paying for this? Then what?
It's costly. I mean, it's costly in terms of private care, and Beth, I'm sure, would agree with that. I just want to go back for a second to the whole issue of the hospital system. When somebody is being discharged from the hospital, a lot of families think that because they're going to be followed by Medicare for that home health service, which used to go for a lot longer than 6 weeks, but now that's been reduced. So being able to help that family, as Beth said, begin to look at what is possible. One of the things I suggest to families who may have a sibling or somebody out of state who's unable to be right here to help the elder or the parent is that they can contribute to that fund in some way. They can add to the quality of that person's life. It's all about quality of life, and we would all probably agree at this table that home is always best, but sometimes it's not possible. And so, again, looking at the big picture of that person going home and being able to stay at home, you have to look at the cost.
Okay, more to talk about, but we're just going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Waterville Creates, inviting you to Variety, an evening of exceptional entertainment in support of the arts on October 19th. WatervilleCreates.org. Maine Farmland Trust, celebrating 20 years of growing the future for farming. Share your stories and get involved at MaineFarmlandTrust20th.org. And the Dempsey Challenge, run, walk, or bike this September to help the Dempsey Center support those impacted by cancer. DempseyChallenge.org.
One day, a few years ago, an Austrian woman's teenage daughter asked to visit a friend. She promised to be back by 3 p.m.
Mom, please trust me. And I say, okay, my dear, I will trust you.
The next time she heard from her, she was in Syria living under ISIS. We follow that mother's journey to get her daughter and grandson back this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 on Maine Public Radio. The Tell Me More Tour's next stop is Bar Harbor. Maine Public News is traveling the state this summer to hear directly from you, to learn what you feel are the most important issues in your community, and how Maine Public News can best serve you in the months and years ahead. The Bar Harbor event takes place this evening at 5:30 at the Abbey Museum. Deputy News Director Susan Sharon will be there, along with Weekend Edition host Jennifer Mitchell. For more information about all the Tell Me More tour visits, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events or the banner ad.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, where to turn for help when dealing with elder care issues. In the studio with me, Ann Quinlan, founder of Healthy Aging Matters, Bethany Lawrence, registered nurse and president of Aging Excellence, and Dr. Jabbar Fazeli. He's a specialist in geriatric medicine. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And joining us now is Jane Margeson. She is AARP Maine's Communications Director. And Jane, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you so much.
So, Jane, do you have a sense of how many people provide unpaid care to a loved one in Maine?
Yes, we do. AARP's Public Policy Institute publishes a report every few years called Valuing the Invaluable, and it actually goes state by state to examine many different data sets. But one of the things that we do come up with is how many people are, in fact, family caregivers. And in Maine, it's an astonishing number. 178,000 individuals are family caregivers. And it's actually estimated that the value of the care that they provide, which of course is all unpaid, is valued at $2.2 billion
per
year.
That's significant. And we talked earlier about today's Washington Post article that highlights how the problem in Maine is the combination of the aging population and not enough young workers who can care for them. Is there anything going on at the federal level to support family caregivers, and what's happening in Maine on that front?
Yes, it certainly is a great concern. And you may remember that last year was the first time that November was designated as Maine Family Caregiver Month. And so we're hoping that later on in the year, of course, we can raise more awareness about this. But one of the key factors that we look at, too, is the lack of direct care workers, which is clearly an issue in the state of Maine. But at the federal level, the Raise Family Caregivers Act, which was signed into law in January 2018, and it was sponsored by Senator Collins, it requires the Department of Health and Human Services to develop a strategy to support family caregivers across the country. And I'm happy to say that it was just very recently announced that AARP's national volunteer president, Dr. Alicia Georges, has been appointed to the National Family Caregiving Advisory Council. And she brings a wealth of experience and dedication to these topics that are just so critical, not just here in Maine, of course, but across the country.
Okay, and what kinds of resources does AARP have available to support family caregivers?
Yes, we have a wealth of resources, and they're all absolutely free, and you certainly don't need to be an AARP member to receive any of these. And the easiest way to get them, I think, is just to send us an email at me@aarp.org. But we, in the state of Maine, we actually developed a Maine Caregiver Resource Guide. So it's state-specific. There are resources across the state, what's going on in your county, everything from transportation options to, you know, just important phone numbers and resources that could be helpful. AARP also has a caregiver resource center online that has an enormous amount of tools and resources and support ideas. There are videos. It's very interactive, and there's a wealth of information there. We also here in Maine have a wonderful piece called Prepare to Care, which is a great planning guide for families. If you know you're kind of on the brink of needing to get into the world of caregiving, this is a terrific resource and a great place to start. One thing I don't know if the panel will be discussing later, too, is we also have a lot of resources that are wonderful for employers and employees. So, you know, employers who know that they've got employees on their staff who are caregiving may not be aware of all the challenges that might bring to the workplace. So the easiest way to kind of start that conversation and say, look, maybe I could work from home one day a week and that would be really helpful, or, you know, whatever might work best, so that the employer can support the work, but that the, you know, that it's a two-way street. You want to make sure that everybody feels supported. Right. And then finally, I would just mention that we have a home fit guide, which is a wonderful way to take a look at the loved one's home and make sure that you really have everything in place that will enable them to stay in their home safely throughout the caregiving process.
Okay, well, that's a ton of great resources. Thank you, Jane. Jane Margeson is the Communications Director for AARP. Thanks for calling. And just before that, we were talking a little bit about how someone goes about paying for help when they need it. And Dr. Fuseli, you did have some information you wanted to share.
Right. Well, there are resources that we direct them to, like Area Agency on Aging, for example, is one of my go-to for people who can't afford paying. If someone meets criteria for Maine Care, we encourage them to get a case manager and go through the process of applying, even if there's an upfront expense to help them navigate that system if they can afford it. But ultimately, you know, if they're on Maine Care, they can qualify for PCA services, personal care attendants coming to their home, provided an evaluation is done and they feel that they need a certain level of care at home to be able to stay at home. So the issue with that, though, is that given the limitation on budget, there's always a waiting list.
Oh, yes.
So in order to control expenditure, there's always going to be a waiting list so that the numbers per year don't exceed a certain amount that's affordable for the state. And back to what Jane was saying, so if we're looking at $2.2 billion a year, if we paid the caregivers who are doing the work, it just shows you how big of a gap there is
right.
in what's budgeted and what could be spent. So while we say we wish there were more workers, at the same time we're looking at more workers doing the work, but we don't have the money to pay them.
Right. Okay. Anne, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to back up a second. I've done this work in three states, and one of the things that I've found is that going back to the corporate, you know, model, they have some of them have childcare within their companies. What I would love to see a larger conversation happening around developing adult daycares within these larger companies that have more than maybe 100 or 200 employees. And just to imagine the anxiety of a daughter or a son who may be envisioning mom walking down the street in her nightgown because they can't be there.
It's the same as having a young child.
It is the same anxiety, and that person is not present at their job.
Yes.
They are focusing on their own anxiety. And anyway, that's just something that I've seen happen in certain situations, but I would love to see that come together in Maine, because in the rural areas of Maine, this would be a tremendous answer to this issue.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. What came up a lot in that is the idea of people being able to stay at home.
Yes.
And Beth, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what a caregiver can do to make the home environment more conducive, more safe to an aging parent or aging loved one.
Absolutely. So a lot of times we will use occupational therapy and physical therapists to provide education on home safety. And we like to modify any of the environments that might cause any injury. So one level living is great if people have that, but, you know, just adapting the environment. So we make sure we have proper handrails, we have adaptive equipment if needed, you know, shower chairs and grab bars, and we try to modify the home so that there aren't areas that are typical for injuries, such as throw rugs. We try to remove those. We try to make sure that the people do have, you know, someone available to check in on them, or they might have a life alert system so that if there is some injury at home that they can call for help. Or, you know, with technology now too, like I said, there's remote monitoring or an auto fall detection. If somebody does fall and they can't respond themselves, that it will automatically alert someone to safety. But definitely we take a look at all of the different rooms in the home. We tried the other significant, which I think will come up in our topics, would be just medication management, making sure that their medication is safe and that they're dispensing it properly and are compliant, and that there aren't any issues related to that as well. So definitely all of the different areas within the home, that the bathrooms, the kitchens, the bedrooms, just to make sure they have proper equipment and are using the equipment appropriately.
Okay, great. Let's go ahead to a call now. This is Susan Weary calling from UNE. Hi, Susan. You're on the line.
Hi. Thank you very much, and thanks so much for taking my call. This has been a great, great conversation. And I just wanted to talk with the panelists and to let your listeners know that the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine recently was awarded a significant grant from HRSA to really help transform primary care practices and create training enhancements across all of the health professions. And this is sort of all in the service of promoting the health and well-being of all older Mainers through developing what's being called age-friendly health systems, which focus on the four M's: mobility, medication, mentation, and to me, most importantly, what matters most to the older adult, him or herself. So in these age-friendly health systems, we're really focusing on health promotion as well as disease intervention, recognizing that when we talk about older adults now, we're talking about a great deal of variety, from very healthy to very ill and very frail individuals. So I hope that you will be hearing more from us, and I'd just like to ask the panelists if they're aware of the movement, if you will, to create more age-friendly health systems and using this 4M framework. Because I heard people talking about medication compliance, but I'd also like to put in a plug for medication review. We know that one of the biggest impacts on health for older adults is this thing of polypharmacy, taking a lot of medication and then having accumulated side effects. So oftentimes adhering to medication means getting off a few of them.
I think, Susan, this is an area Dr. Fuseli looks at closely, right?
Yes, and it's really a primary focus. What not to do first as far as medications and reducing the number of unnecessary medications, because they compound the problem with dementia and complications like falls, like loss of independence.
So you're talking about antipsychotics that have other effects and they're not necessarily helping? Or
well, that's the tip of the iceberg, the antipsychotics. But you could be looking at just sleep aid like Benadryl. Mm-hmm. And people would think that's benign. I've taken it for 20 years. It's not a problem. But wait till you hit 70 or 80. And then you're falling, you're more confused, you get in delirium, and nobody's aware that that's one little pill that never caused a problem is now a problem. Sometimes you have combinations. Somebody's on an antidepressant, then they get a pain pill like Ultram, then the combination can cause issues, and the list goes on and on. But the tip of the iceberg is really using the antipsychotics for dementia directly. And that's a bigger problem than all the other medications.
Okay, thank you for calling, Susan. And just to follow up on that a little bit, then what does somebody do? Just get all the medications reviewed and managed by a physician?
Well, ideally it would be a geriatric review, but back to Susan's point, I mean, the reason there's a push for better or age-friendly medicine in primary care is that there aren't enough geriatricians to do all the work.
So we have a shortage of everything.
Right. So So you got to train the primary care doctors to do that work. But the medication review is one of the essentials of geriatrics. But you got to keep in mind, you can't tell a dementia patient, do this and that.
Right.
And then see them in 6 months, mm-hmm. which is what happens sometimes.
So that was my question for the caregiver who maybe has a mother who says she took her medications but didn't. Yeah, how does a caregiver deal with medication management on a day-to-day basis?
I think it's a big issue for families. I mean, a lot of times it's the family caregiver or a member of the family who actually fills up those medication vials.
Yeah, and watches the person take them.
You've probably done it yourself, yep. Cindy. And watching the person taking them, but then going back the next day and realizing they've taken 3 doses of the same medication on a Wednesday when it should have been maybe right. twice on a... So that's, and again, going back to what Dr. Fuseli is saying, we have a wonderful resource right here in Portland, Coastal Wellness Pharmacy, and the compounding pharmacist there will look at all of those medications. And again, it's similar to what Dr. Fuseli is saying here, recognizing what the interactions and contraindications may be among those medications that can cause a lot of, in fact, can increase the dementia or the confusion okay. for the individual.
We'll do our best to post some of these resources everyone's yeah. mentioning mm-hmm. on our Facebook page and on our website. We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Maine Community Foundation, where you can create your own charitable fund to benefit Maine. Learn more at mainecf.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest, George Packer, will discuss Richard Holbrook, a legendary diplomat whose outsized appetites, ego, and impact offer insight into a golden age of American influence. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air.
It's okay. I'm estimating that this little guy is probably about 5 days old.
That's Hannah Shaw, a.k.a. the Kitten Lady. Her mission is rescuing orphaned neonatal and older kittens and teaching people how to care for them. She has a new book called Tiny But Mighty. Join us.
And that's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Getting Help with Elder Care. My guests today are Ann Quinlan, founder of Healthy Aging Matters, Dr. Jabbar Fuseli, who is a geriatrician, and Beth Lawrence, founder and president of Aging Excellence. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And joining me on the line now is Lori Campbell. She's Family Caregiver Support Supervisor and Caregiver Respite Program Coordinator with Southern Maine Agency on Aging. Lori, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you just give us a quick overview of some of the services your organization provides for caregivers and anyone who's starting to think about elder care?
Oh, certainly. So we consider caregivers to be unpaid family members and friends who are providing care for an older adult. It doesn't have to be hands-on care. It can be finances, medications, home upkeep, emotional support. We offer telephone consultations and or face-to-face meetings at our Scarborough office with caregivers to discuss available resources and try to start some of that long-term care planning that I was hearing about earlier in the program, which is vitally important because of the long waiting lists that people are facing. We also offer educational classes for caregivers on a variety of topics and a monthly caregiver support group.
Okay, great. And what are some of the most common issues you're seeing with the families who come to you for help?
I think how to pay for services, both in-home services and long-term care services and facilities. So we do a lot of counseling surrounding main care applications and how to manage resources to be able to get the care that the person needs in their home, or perhaps if they do need to go into some sort of a long-term care setting.
Okay. Do you have anything else you want to share? Any advice for caregivers?
Well, I think reaching out for support, even if you're just starting the process, it's a long journey. We say it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I think knowledge is power. So finding out what's available for resources for you, the older adult, figuring out what resources they have to pay for services. If they don't have resources, how might they get state assistance or other types of funding to pay for those needed services. And I agree that most older people do want to stay at home, and we certainly would try to help families help their loved ones do that by connecting them with resources and supporting them in the process.
Okay, well, great, Lori. Thank you for your time today. Lori Campbell is with the Southern Maine Agency on Aging. And what she talked there, again, it's you got to reach out for help. That's basically the bottom line.
Absolutely.
Right? And Beth, there was some aspect of that help that you wanted to talk about with lifestyle.
Yeah, lifestyle medicine. So there's another push for lifestyle medicine. As we speak about describing medication and such, a lot of people are being very thoughtful about their diet, their exercise, and just their overall health, and changing their lifestyle can dramatically reduce the need for certain types of medication with the weight loss and management for blood pressure and other diagnoses. And definitely there can never be too much said about exercise in general for every diagnosis. And there's been a lot of research regarding Alzheimer's and different types of dementia, but just in general that people are getting and promoting a healthy lifestyle, and which would really help them in the aging process. I would like to say, too, just with the Area Agency on Aging, they do have some really wonderful programs to help support the lifestyle, our healthy lifestyles, with the senior games and promotion of healthy steps and matter of balance and a lot of the programs that they put out as well. And just to speak about the funding issue as well, and I know that there are some other programs or insurance programs through long-term care insurance and veterans benefits that might help fund some of the clients that need services as well. So it is really reaching out to resources and the area agencies and trying to find out what type of benefit people might qualify for.
All right, great. We have an email from Lenny. She says, I'm in my 70s and grew up on a dairy farm, one of six. My mother was one of 14. And at different times, both of her parents lived with us, as well as other aging relatives and younger relatives. I think it taught all of us that family takes care of each other. When my parents were into their 90s and needing care, we all took turns and even did our own hospice care for both of them. I think role modeling is the key. My children now say they're going to take care of me, and it can continue for generations. So thank you for that email, Lenny. And that is sort of the old main way. I think if people could do that, they would.
Well, it's also cultural. You know, I think it's cultural. We're not necessarily in rural Maine, but I grew up in Ireland. And my memory as a child would have been helping Mrs. O'Brien down the road carry her groceries.
Uh-huh.
You know, we were raised that way, the youngest of five children. And when the aunties came, some of them were nurses, but there was that continuation. There was that continuum of family involvement or somebody picking up the phone and just making sure that. So I think culturally, as a society, we're not going to go back to that. Lenny's story is beautiful, and it's very moving to know that those families are still out there and able to do that. So how do we recreate that? We recreate it through age-friendly communities. We have extended community. We now have village to village, where people are looking more at perhaps helping one another out right in their own neighborhood.
Okay. And we're going to go to a call now from Megan calling from Portland. Hi, Megan. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
You're taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
Sure. So my family has been providing care for my grandparents for over 10 years now. It's just my grandmother left. And one thing that I've noticed both with our family and with other families, that oftentimes the caregivers are struggling to manage the different appointments and the medications and everything, and it can become really overwhelming. So my question was, are there any resources available for, like, elder case management or anything of that sort, even if somebody doesn't have main care? What are those resources like, and is there anything that can kind of help those families to manage everything?
Right. Well, it's private duty case management.
What does that mean?
It means you hire somebody who's a geriatric case manager, and a lot of them have sliding scales, so it's not like the cost is not cost prohibitive. And sometimes it's worth it because you're saving, because you're streamlining your care or you're avoiding certain things that you don't have to do normally. And when somebody's having 10 appointments in a month, a case manager will ask the right questions, like, do you really need all of them?
Or with the medications interfering with each other.
Exactly. Right? So then they would have a conversation with the primary care doctor and say, you know, I know this person had a heart attack 30 years ago, but they're 95 now, and the care plan has changed. Do we need a cardiology consult every month or every 3 months, and so on?
Where but does somebody get a private case manager?
Anne is one of them, Southern Maine Area Agency on Aging. A lot of geriatricians would have the resources of their local community case managers that they can access.
Okay, Beth?
Excuse me. So I'm a nationally certified geriatric care manager, and there is a website for care managers who, for private, would be aginglifecare.org. And if you type in your zip code, then it will give you a list of people in that organization in your local area that could work as private care managers as well. So we have an integrated business in Portland as well that we have aging life care experts or care managers that can help and on a private basis, and, you know, as needed, be on call or continue to work with clients throughout the continuum of providers that they see in the community.
Okay. Whole bunch of questions coming in. We have an email from Tom. At our computer shop in Ellsworth, we are spending an increasing amount of time assisting customers with managing their computer and online passwords. We would like to reach out to caregivers as well to make sure that those in their care are adequately protected online and have good backup of their information. That's interesting, something that we don't always think about.
True. I mean, it may bring up an issue of the scams. So the elderly are more vulnerable. We know how to deal with it because we're more exposed. And some of these scams are getting sophisticated, like calling from Medicare or calling from Social Security asking for your information.
So part of elder care has become cyber care.
It has.
Right. Okay. Yes, Anne.
I just wanted to mention that I believe if you have a landline, which many older people do, that you can actually access that control. It's troll control.
Troll control.
And your provider, your landline provider can add that onto your service so that it comes up as a troll control. And once you look at that number, you don't have to answer it.
I see.
And that's a safety. It's safety.
Well, thanks. So we will go to Penny now, calling from Bristol. Hi, Penny. You're on the line.
Hi. My mother had a stroke at age 86. This was in 2003. And it was obvious, right? My sister happened to be there visiting, and my mother just started talking in tongues and, you know, in odd language. And my sister called the ambulance right away, and they got to the hospital. And then she flew by helicopter at sunset, which was a thrill she didn't get over for a long time. She would talk about it in gestures, and I'd know just what she was talking about. She went to Women and Brigham, and they were going to do TPA and all the rest, but it turned out not to be that kind of a stroke. But in the end, she had what's called Wernicke's aphasia, where she speaks in a different language, and it really is kind of a language. I was quite interested. But every so often, out would pop a short English sentence, and you'd go, oh, my God, she's talking, it's fixed. Well, it wasn't fixed, but it was kind of exciting when she would say something. And but we kind of got to understand her, and she was good with gestures and facial movements. And
Penny, were you caring for her? Did you have somebody caring for her?
Well, we had a caretaker for her who got pretty burned out after a year. And after that, we had an extraordinary extraordinarily wonderful caretaker, a woman from Uganda, that it was just total luck that her prior client had died. And my sister had talked to some agency, and she, when we were getting the first caretaker, and then she called him back for the second one, he said, you know, I've just heard from someone who would be perfect for you, and she was. And
oh, that's
great. My mother
great.
Lived to be lived for a total of another 6 years.
Oh.
Kind of fading away as she went along. But when she first had the stroke, when we had the first caretaker, my siblings and I, there are three of us, and two of us live in Maine, and one lived near her in Massachusetts, and we would do the weekends.
Penny. I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off, but we have a whole bunch of calls coming in. But it's really good to hear you share your story and how you were able to actually find a good caregiver. So thank you for sharing that. And I wanted to do a quick jump over to Maggie calling from Hollowell. Hi, Maggie. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. I just wanted to double back to volunteers. Because there are plenty of us out here who belong to all-age-friendly committees and Neighbors Driving Neighbors and the Catholic Charities of Maine, and we're not highly skilled like the people on your program, but we're doing a service, and it's meaningful for all of us.
That's really something. Thank you, Maggie, for calling. And that does point to the fact there's another avenue there, mm-hmm. turning to...
And it's a valuable service. I mean, we depend on that. And like your caller or your email from a rural area, in rural communities, they may have an extended family and they have a lot of support. In urban communities, the volunteers are necessary gap filler.
Okay. There's an email from Dana. We'll have to be quick with this. My wife and I are caring for my 92-year-old mother. She has severe dementia. We've reached for assistance through our local hospital, and they were very responsive. But my mother refuses to entertain the thought of others coming in to help us support her. Do any of you have experience with this type of situation? Any suggestions or strategies? In a minute, can we address that? That's a big question for many.
Right. Well, I was actually going to mention it earlier. So the sense that wanting to be independent is not just wanting to be home.
Right.
It's also independent of people coming into your home. And it's hard to convince some of our patients who may not have an awareness of their needs. And so that's where the advanced care planning becomes very important. So knowing, having a power of attorney, somebody who could step in and say, no, Mom, you really do need this help. And have the authority to sign off on it.
Okay, real quick.
Just quickly, I just wanted to say that when I'm introducing a caregiver to a family member, I just introduce them as a friend. This is a friend of mine, and they'd love to have a cup of tea with you.
That's right. A good
As long as it's client-centered and you can find some common interest with the caregiver, a lot of times that will help you get through the gate. So.
Good advice. Thank you. And much more advice we could get from you, but we're out of time. Beth Jabbar, and thank you all for joining us today. Bethany Lawrence is the founder and president of Aging Excellence. Dr. Jabbar Fozelli is a geriatrician. Ann Quinlan is founder of Healthy Aging Matters. She is hosting a conference on elder care on August 24th at the University of New England in Portland. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Julie Pike took your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.